And with that, unless there are any questions, we're here to hear, we'll start with argument in Inri Trust of Candiotti. Before we start, Judge Jones has a question that he wants to pose to counsel.
Yeah, it's not so much a question as it is a disclosure. I learned in the course of I was preparing for this case that one of the expert witnesses in this case was Gene Stewart. And I need to disclose that Ms. Stewart was of counsel at my law firm from January of 1994 through April of 1995. That's the Moore Giles firm. During that period of time, I was a partner at the firm. So I wanted to disclose that to the parties. Obviously, that's something for you to think about. If anyone wants to make a motion regarding that, certainly you have some time to do that. I'm not promising how I would rule on such a motion, but I wanted to make that disclosure.
Okay, and we're ready.
Good afternoon. David Swank, registration number 23408, appearing today on behalf of Mark Vance Condiotti, who's the settlor of the Mark Vance Condiotti Irrevocable GST Trust, the appellant in this matter. May it please the court, Your Honors, this is a case of first impression in Colorado and nationally. It involves the construction and interpretation of an intentionally defective grantor trust. A grantor trust is a highly specialized and unique type of trust. The settlor of a grantor trust is considered to be the owner of the trust assets and is thus required to pay 100% of the income tax on the trust income. The Treasury regulations under Section 675 explain why the grantor is treated as the owner of the trust. In a grantor trust, administrative control is exercisable primarily for the grantor rather than the beneficiaries. That is what differentiates a grantor trust. This provides opportunities for a grantor, but also a significant trade-off because the grantor is required to pay 100% of the tax liabilities. In this case, the provision which triggers grantor trust status is the power of substitution. The substitution power in the trust provided that settlor, without the approval or consent of any person acting in a fiduciary capacity, has the power to reacquire the trust corpus by substituting other property of an equivalent value. The provision tracks the language of the Internal Revenue Code Section 675-4C verbatim. The operative term used in the code section is property of equivalent value. There is no reference to fair market value in the trust, the code section, the regulations, or any of the revenue rules. Settlor attempted to exercise his power of substitution by offering his promissory note in exchange for a trust corpus in an amount equal to the face amount of the note. Trustees rejected the substitution. The case proceeded to trial. The trial court was presented with two different standards.
Pardon me for interrupting, if I may, Mr. Swank. As I understand the record, there were actually two reasons why the trustees and then the probate court rejected the transaction that the settlor proposed. And the second reason was that it was a loan and that the trust instrument did not give the loan power to the settlor. That remained with the trustees. Am I right about that?
Yes, there were two grounds that the trustees petitioned for instructions with regard to.
And the probate court ruled on both those grounds, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.
Settlor's position was that the note should be valued at its face amount. That is the value of the note for federal income, gift, and estate tax purposes. It is also the value as determined by state law, specifically Section 15-12-906-2B of the Colorado Probate Code values notes when they are being distributed for from decedent's estates. The trustees, on the other hand, argue that the note is not worth its face amount and that it ought to be valued instead for what a willing buyer would pay for it. In other words, a market value standard. The trustees' brief failed to even address the probate code section cited by the settlor, and the trustees rely on Colorado Arbor Club, which is a real property tax assessment case as their authority for using a market value in Colorado. Rather than selecting one of the competing methods, the trial court erroneously decided that both standards must be met. The trial court went even further and specifically ruled that a promissory note cannot possibly meet both standards and thus could never be used in the exercise of a substitution power. Neither the trustees nor the trial court cited a single case, revenue ruling, or scholarly journal article to support its conclusion. On the contrary, the professional literature is replete with articles from expert commentators specifically stating that a promissory note can in fact be used in the exercise of a substitution power, and that a note would be valued at its base amount as long as it bore an adequate rate of interest. There was unrebutted expert witness testimony from Mr. Kevin Millar and Mr. Dennis Whitmer that a promissory note was property that could permissibly be used in the exercise of a substitution power. The trial court's ruling ignored the United States Tax Court's decision in Frazee versus Commissioner. The Frazee court stated, by enacting 7872, Congress indicated that virtually all gift transactions involving the transfer of money or properties would be valued using the current applicable federal rate.
Pardon me for interrupting again, Mr. Swank, but I want to put my concern about this on the table, if I may, please. I want to know why this wasn't a loan, and I want to begin with 7872, which you rely upon very heavily, and which the Frazee case relies upon. And 7872 is treatment of loans with below market interest rates. And I have read every word of that, and it focuses entirely, that entire section, on loans. I'm wondering whether you are implicitly conceding that this transaction is a loan. And if it is a loan, then isn't it appropriate for the trustees to say, no, settler, you didn't have this power, if there was going to be a loan, it is up to us, not to you?
No, Your Honor, we absolutely are not conceding that this is a loan. The court in Frazee makes very clear that 7872 has broad applicability to valuing many different types of transactions. It is not limited to loans. In fact, it states virtually all gift transactions involving the transfer of money or property would be valued using the current applicable federal rate.
But that's not what the section talks about. It talks entirely about loans.
The title does reference loans, but there's also another provision of the section that says it applies for all subchapters of the Internal Revenue Code. That includes income, gift, and estate tax purposes. The other point, Your Honor, is settler has a power of substitution, and he's free to exercise that by using any property so long as it has an equivalent value.
Well, I understand that the documents give him that power, but if the transaction is not a substitution, if it is indeed a loan, and I guess what we're talking about here is it's pretty clear to me that the document gives the trustees the power to say, no, you don't get to take a loan here. And if they're right that this was a loan and not a substitution, then they have the authority to say no, didn't they?
Yes, that's entirely correct, Your Honor. But the two points that cut against that approach is, one, this is a trust construction case, and the intent of the settlor is critical. And the objective in construing a trust is to determine the intent of the settlor and effectuate it. In this case, the settlor's unrebutted testimony that the settlor intended this to be a substitution, not a loan.
Pardon me for interrupting you again, but I don't read the cases that talk about the intent of the settlor as meaning the settlor's intent at the time he or she wishes to have a transaction. It's at the time that the trust is drafted. That's the focus. And the fact that later in time, and this time 11 years later, that the settlor characterizes a transaction as a substitution as opposed to a loan, I don't think that's what that law was talking about. I think the law was talking about at the time the trust instrument is drafted, what does it say about the settlor's intent then?
I understand that and recognize that, Your Honor. The other point, though, in the grantor trust context is the regulations provide specifically that the administrative control is exercisable in the favor of the grantor rather than the beneficiaries. And that supports the notion that Settler has the flexibility to exercise the control. And he specifically intended that this was a substitution. And there are numerous professional articles from prominent trust and estate practitioners, all of which support the settlor's ability to use a note in an asset substitution power, and it's not considered a loan.
Other than the case you cited from the tax court, are there any cases on point in terms of the argument that you're making right now?
Unfortunately not, Your Honor. This is a case of first impression with regard to a substitution power in the grantor trust context.
Did the trial court make any credibility determinations about whether the court believed Mr. Condiotti when he testified that this was his intent?
To my knowledge, the court didn't focus on the credibility aspect. The trial court simply focused on its conclusion. The authority relied upon was Love versus Olson and the Cash Now stores, neither of which involved a trust, neither of which involved a substitution power. The facts of those cases were not remotely on point to the present case.
Thank you.
The substitution in this case is a transfer involving money or property, and revenue rulings 2008-22, which is cited by the trustees, require a determination of whether there is a gift component involved. In other words, whether there are any changes to the respective balance sheets of each side, because that ruling states a grantor cannot exercise the power to substitute assets in a manner that will reduce the value of the trust corpus or increase settlor's net worth. That's why Frazee is the most pertinent authority for deciding the value. And again, the standard is equivalent value. It is not a fair market value standard.
One of the questions that the trial judge asked, I think it was during the closing arguments, was how can you deal with equivalency unless, because if you have securities in the trust, it could be volatile. They could go down, but they could, and presumably over the last several years, did go up. You don't have that with a promissory note, particularly one that's at 1.27%. It's going to stay that. So how do you factor that into the equivalency concept, if at all?
Well, that's the advantage of the present value method that is conducted under the IRS methodology. It simply takes the present value of the stream of payments under the note. The government prescribes a minimum rate of interest called the applicable federal rate, which all parties agree that the settlor's note met that minimum level. Whether it's a different mix of assets, that doesn't affect the equivalency of value. You take a snapshot.
I understand it doesn't affect it, but should it?
No, because the trust document specifically states that settlor does not need to obtain the approval or consent of anyone acting in a fiduciary capacity. And those questions regarding the asset mix, those go to fiduciary type considerations. And the fact of the grantor trust rules stating that the benefit is exercisable for the benefit of the grantor rather than the beneficiaries is key.
If I may, what does that mean though about the equivalent value? Isn't it pretty clear that the trustees can determine whether it is of the equivalent value? Don't they have a role to play there?
The trustees absolutely have a role to play. That's in fact their only role in the transaction, is the limited duty to determine whether it is in fact equivalent value.
Because if it's not of equivalent value, then the trust loses the maximization of the estate tax benefit, and thus they would be violating their fiduciary duties under the document itself, right?
Correct, and that's why it is a tax decision, Your Honor. That's why the tax standard should be used to determine equivalency of value. That's the consequence of not following Revenue Ruling 2008-22, is that the property would be included in the settlor's estate for estate tax purposes. With regard to the loan issue, trustees argue that in any other context, this would be considered a loan. Asking the court to ignore the context is a lot like asking Mrs. Lincoln, other than that, how did you enjoy the play? The context is critical. And in this case, the context is that it's a grantor trust, and the settlor specifically reserved the power to substitute assets. And he did so. I'd like to reserve my limited remaining time for rebuttal.
It's about 17 seconds, but you'll have it.
I'll speak in staccato.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Honorable E. Brash, registration number 13155. Attorney for the appellee is Patricia G. Cagliani and MidFirst Bank as co-trustees. I'd also like to introduce my colleague, Emlyn Ruiz, who's here from our Durango office. This case pits a settler's attempt to regain control of the assets he placed in trust against the duty of the trustees to act in the best interest of the beneficiary. The central issue is whether a settlor can impose on the trustees a transaction that significantly reduces the value of the beneficiary's interest. The trial court considered two critical questions. First, whether the proposed substitution offered property of an equivalent value. And second, whether the transaction was in fact a loan. Starting with the second question, offers this court the opportunity to rule on narrow grounds, because affirming the trial court's determination that the transaction constitutes a loan, with the trustees under no obligation to lend, would be dispositive. The settlor of this trust proposes to exchange his unsecured promissory note payable at the end of 9 years with interest at 1.27%. in return for the entire corpus of the trust. That transaction, assets in return for a promissory note, is a loan under any definition of Colorado statutory or case law. And if it is a loan, the proposed transaction fails. If I went up to Ms. Brzees and asked her to give me everything she had in her pocketbook in return for my IOU, that's a loan, no matter what separate agreements we might have. But let's assume that it is not a loan and is rather a substitution. Whether the promissory note is of an equivalent value to the trust. At the outset, it's important to note that this is not a tax case. While some provisions of the trust, including the power of substitution itself, may have been included in the context of federal estate tax planning, Colorado law exclusively controls the construction and administration of a Colorado trust. Let me offer a brief analogy. Section 1031 of the Internal Revenue Code allows for the exchange of like-kind property tax-free if several conditions are met. Further, assume that the contract, which might even be called a tax-free exchange agreement, sets forth all the terms of exchange, including those necessary to qualify under 1031. When a dispute arises, say over whether the exchange property has been timely designated, the motive may be to preserve federal tax treatment, but the construction of the agreement is determined solely under Colorado law. As to Section 7872, Judge Bernard noted, the caption of that section is treatment of loans with below market interest rates. The undisputed record at trial is that the fair market value of the note is roughly half its face amount.
Mr. Betts, can I just go back for a second to the loan issue? When the trial court made the ruling that this transaction was a loan. Was that a ruling as a matter of fact, or was it a legal conclusion that we reviewed de novo?
I would say it was a missed issue of fact, Your Honor, because it requires those facts of the definition in order to be there. But ultimately, there is a de novo legal decision as to whether or not it is a loan.
Thank you.
The appellant here relies on Section 7872 as a method of market valuation. In fact, 7872 is merely a safe harbor from untoward gift and other tax consequences that don't apply here. Appellants also noted, and we also remarked on Revenue Ruling 2008-22, if anything, that ruling reaffirms the concept that the trustee does have an obligation to determine the actual equivalency of value. Three states have gone so far as to codify that revenue ruling: Delaware, which is important as a trust jurisdiction, Idaho, which is a sister uniform probate code state, and South Dakota. And Delaware went even farther than the ruling in clarifying that it's the trustee's job to determine equivalency. So how do you resolve the tension between the desires of a settlor and the interests of a beneficiary? A trust is all about its beneficiaries. All other interests are secondary. Within the bounds of fiduciary discretion, the trustee's loyalties run exclusively to the beneficiary. Once the trust is created, the settlor becomes, in the words of the trial court, a stranger to the trust. Consider the proposed transaction here from the perspective of the trustees. If they had accepted the offer, first, they would now be holding an asset that has no upside and offers a very poor return, in direct contravention of their obligations under the Colorado Prudent Investment Act. Second, the portfolio of the trust would be concentrated in a single asset with no flexibility or opportunity to diversify the portfolio, again violating their fiduciary duties. The trustees would then face the Hobson's choice. They'd have to consider the possibility of selling the note at a deep discount, effectively marking the asset to market by realizing a loss of several million dollars. In this light, the trial court was correct in strictly construing and reserving any reserve rights against the settlor and in favor of the beneficiary. This was not, as the appellant characterized it, an act of judicial freelancing, but simply the application of fundamental principles of Colorado trust law. The issue of intent has come up in several different contexts. Appellant would have us believe that the current intent of a living trust settlor determines how the trust should be construed, and determines that now, not at the time of the drafting. For example, in his reply brief, appellant argues that settlor intended the transaction to be a substitution and not a loan, and that settlor's intent must be effectuated. The trial court characterized a similar argument by noting the settlor's primary support for the idea that the promissory note is a substitution of property rather than a loan rests largely on the fact that he has chosen to call it a substitution of property. In fact, the current intent of a settlor is of no import here. Colorado law carefully circumscribes the situations where evidence of settlor intent is even admissible: fraud, mistake, duress, ambiguity, none of which were found by the trial court. If living settlers had the broad authority to interpret their own irrevocable trusts, that would constitute a reserved right of amendment, reversing most of the benefits sought at the creation of the trust. Similarly, if every right of substitution could be read to include the right to borrow, then most grantor trusts, because most grantor trusts contain the substitution clause, most grantor trusts would be obligated to lend to their settlors on demand, even though the grantor trust rules have separate provisions for loans to settlors. Finally, the Colorado Probate Court Code does not seek to ensure a favorable federal tax outcome for trust settlors based on their self-serving statements of intent. Mr. Swank has noted Colorado law in terms of valuing notes in decedent's estate at the time of distribution. That is, in fact, the starting point for a decedent's estate in Colorado. You value it at the face amount. But that's one in a decedent's estate context. And two, it's only the starting point in distributing an estate. And it's always subject to the objection of any beneficiary who can claim that the valuation was not fair or that he wants an equal amount of every asset or a variety of other solutions. So it's really just the default provision for purposes of starting on that. On the issue of commentators or the professional literature, as Mr. Swank calls it, because the stakes are so high, the trust in the state field attracts sophisticated technicians who try to patch together various provisions of the tax code to achieve a more favorable result. But commentators don't make law, they comment on it. On our issue, the commentators are less than unanimous or clear. One heavily relied on by the appellant, Ronald Alcott, effectively recanted his view in an article published just days before the trial in this case, saying conformity with Section 7872 does not preclude a fair market value inquiry.
Is that in our record somewhere?
It is. It is. It's in the there were post-trial oral arguments, and there's a record of that. That's where it was made. The indisputable effect of approving this proposal would be to leave the trust in its beneficiary with an asset substantially less valuable than the assets it now holds. Neither state fiduciary law nor federal tax law sanctions or requires that result. We ask that you reaffirm the ruling of the trial court on all counts. Thank you, Mr. Swank, and thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Brash. Mr. Swank, I know it's a short period of time, but you got 17 seconds.
Thank you. I respectfully invite the court to consider the Treasury regulations for grantor trusts, which confirm that administrative control is exercisable primarily for the benefit of the settlor. That rule, along with settlor's intent and the pertinent authority from prominent commentators, supports settlor's ability to do precisely what he did, and that's a sound basis on which to reverse the trial court. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted. We will issue an opinion in due course.